Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You can lead a bank to the funding trough, but can you really make them lend? They are private businesses, after all, so when the British government started talking about a binding agreement to force lending today, what some experts heard was the closest thing yet to nationalizing the banks. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal, who's taking a well-deserved holiday on this Martin Luther King Day, the 19th of January. There was no holiday from the ongoing financial crisis in Europe today. It began with news the Royal Bank of Scotland is facing a record yearly loss, totaling as much as $41 billion. That brought the announcement of a second rescue plan for Britain's ailing banks. Prime Minister Gordon Brown has decided to insure banks against defaults on all kinds of toxic loans, but he wants a legally binding commitment that they'll make more credit available to British businesses and homebuyers. We reached Harvard University economist Kenneth Rogoff in London. He calls this quasi-nationalization that gives the British government enough control to direct the banks to make loans. And he suggests that's a leap toward full nationalization.
This is a gigantic further step in the financial crisis. This is historic. We may see something in the United States in the not-too-distant future that parallels it because we have similar problems.
Indeed, this sounds a lot like the line that's been coming out of President-elect Obama's economic planners in the past couple of days. They're now vowing the new administration's focus will shift away from bailing out banks and toward making more credit available. In more ways than one, what's happening overseas sounds a lot like what's been happening here at home. The French government is set to meet tomorrow with executives of the country's auto industry, one of France's biggest employers. President Nicolas Sarkozy has already promised a lot of money, and one official says the government is prepared to take a bigger stake in the car makers in return for more financial aid. Meantime, the Chinese government is rolling out some new incentives for car buyers starting tomorrow. And since the Chinese buy brands from around the world, Detroit's big three are watching closely. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports from Shanghai.
China's stimulus package cuts the sales tax on little cars, those with engines 1.6 liters and below. Beijing wants to rev up the fuel-efficient market, and so do automakers like GM. They're banking on emerging markets to offset losses elsewhere. Independent analyst Jiaxing Guang.
China is critical now. North America and Europe are hurting. So is Japan. The only markets that may grow right now are China, Brazil, India, and Russia.
2 years ago, new car sales in China zipped along at a 22% growth pace. That dropped off to 7 last year, hence the stimulus. If it works, China's potential is like that of the U.S. back in the 50s. Here's Michael Dunn of J.D. Power and Associates.
In China, 80% of the people who buy a new car this year will be buying a car for the first time in their lives.
But what brands will they pick? Once upon a time, GM and VW logos owned the streets of Shanghai and Beijing. But today, Toyota's coming on, as are local brands that aren't the joke they once were. Alfred Tien edits China Automotive Review.
Very possible for Chinese automakers to overtake Volkswagen or GM or Toyota. It's very possible.
And remember, this stimulus is to boost small vehicles, Detroit's historic weakness. The big three want to do a UE in that neighborhood, starting with China. In the last month, both Ford and GM opened new plants here to build and sell pint-sized cars. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
So maybe you've heard President-elect Obama has a few things on his plate, including, it turns out, the official presidential seal. And we're not just talking about the fancy insignia that appears on White House China and the presidential lectern. The seal has also been showing up in a lot of places it's not supposed to. All around Washington, you can buy T-shirts and buttons adorned with the seal. But as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports, that's actually illegal under federal law.
The presidential seal features an eagle surrounded by stars and a golden circle. It looks great on a T-shirt.
I'll take the 2X.
You got the double X?
Yeah.
Okay.
Lyndon George is buying 2 T-shirts from a downtown Washington street vendor. There's a big picture of President-elect Obama on the front. Below it, the presidential seal.
No, I didn't even pay any attention. I was looking at the front of the shirt and the logo. I didn't notice the seal.
Vendor Ann Cagua didn't notice the seal either when she purchased the shirt from the manufacturer. She says this is a lot of fuss for a short-term problem.
They got better things to do, I'm sure, than worrying about, you know, how long are we going to do it? A couple of more months.
But when pressed, Cagua admits she'll probably be selling Obamabilia for at least the next 6 months. Obama's inauguration has become a celebration. There's Hot for Barack hot sauce, along with shot glasses, mouse pads, and bobbleheads. University of Richmond law professor Carl Tobias says the White House can't do much about the use of Obama's image because he's a public figure. The law just tries to prevent the commercialization of the presidential seal.
You could advertise a product and show the seal, and that might lead people to believe that the president had actually endorsed it.
Violators of the law can face 6 months in the slammer. But Tobias thinks White House lawyers will be too busy to prosecute, and he doesn't think they'll need to. A warning letter with the presidential seal on White House stationery will probably suffice. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
A much-welcome breather today for traders on Wall Street. European stocks, on the other hand, couldn't get a break. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Even before the new administration's economic stimulus plan is finalized, some environmental advocates are complaining it doesn't go far enough to create a green energy economy. It could be argued the costs are simply too high. But cities and states across the country are dreaming up creative ways of financing green projects without exhausting their supply of spending green. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
Berkeley professor Dan Kamen likes to open his energy policy lectures with this question.
How many of you in the audience have cell phones? And of course, all the hands go up. And then the next question is, how many of you would have a cell phone if you had to buy 20 years of minutes up front? And no hands go up.
Kamen says the reason cell phone technology took off so fast was because consumers didn't have to pay for everything up front.
Energy is the classic case of something where we don't do that.
Take residential solar panels. The technology eventually pays for itself, but that doesn't make the initial costs any more palatable. Even with the best incentive programs, it can still set back homeowners nearly $20,000. And that's why cities like Berkeley, California, are rethinking the economic model for renewable energy.
I'll just tell you, I was just up in the attic, and everything looks great, so we're all good to go there.
Oh, that's good.
Retired widow Jean Pimentel is meeting with a solar contractor.
The actual installation is only going to take a couple of days.
That's amazing.
Next week, the company will begin installing 11 panels on her Berkeley home and have to reduce her energy bill 85%.
I was always interested in solar power, and I actually got a quote about a year ago just to see if it would be practical. But when I heard the price, I said, no way. I just couldn't afford it at that time.
The only reason Pimentel can now is because she's not paying for it. The city of Berkeley is. She's part of a pilot project that uses city bonds to cover the upfront costs of residential solar. Pimentel pays the city back with interest over 20 years through a surcharge on her property taxes. The added surcharge is roughly equal to the savings on her energy bill, and it stays with the house even if it's sold.
This really opens up a whole new window.
Again, Dan Kamen.
This is just about the most fundamental change I've seen in how we think about clean energy, because every project that has an upfront cost can essentially be amortized away in this process.
Making solar panels more like cell phones, a technology that's suddenly affordable to the masses. Kamen says several states, including Colorado and New York, are considering similar models. Portland, Oregon is using a clean energy investment fund to weatherize entire neighborhoods and eventually the entire city. Kamen says the bigger these programs get, the easier it is to raise capital through bond sales and private investors, and even the federal government. He says by channeling some of the economic stimulus funds into these programs, Congress and the Obama administration could spawn a wave of clean energy spending that would last for decades.
Everyone's biggest investment is in their home. And if you can leverage that investment to get you to a clean energy home, that suddenly takes the federal money that might be on the scale of millions or perhaps billions and suddenly opens up a door to trillions.
All by unlocking the power of the consumer, Jean Pimentel being a prime example.
I think people want this kind of thing. They want to be part of the bigger picture and the greater good.
As a rule, Pimentel lives simply, buying only what she needs and walking and biking most places, even at 74. But she admits she'll feel a thrill when she flips the switch, knowing the electricity she does use now comes from the sun. In Berkeley, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
That kind of out-of-the-box thinking at the state and local level is exactly what some economic experts are calling for. They say we need to test out innovative approaches to get the best results from the new stimulus package. And if we can apply what we've learned in the future, we might even prevent this kind of deep recession from happening again. Commentator Len Berman is among those who think it's a perfect time to do a little experimenting.
Here's a dirty secret about economic stimulus. We're making a lot of this stuff up. It's based on a combination of often inconsistent theory and ambiguous empirical evidence. And we don't have a lot of practice doing it. In recessions past, monetary policy was the main tool to boost the economy because it worked. This time, though, that line is tapped out. Federal interest rates are basically zero and the economy is still sinking. Now we're relying on tax cuts and government spending to do the trick. But we don't know a lot about fiscal policy either. So there's huge disagreement about what works best and how much stimulus to apply. What do we do in the face of our ignorance? At the national level, we probably should try lots of different things, kind of a diversification strategy. We're doing that. But we should also encourage the states to experiment so we can learn what works, rather than mandate a one-size-fits-all approach. The ideal experiment would assign different treatments to different states. States that begin with A through E, tax credits, F through K, infrastructure, and so on. We could even have a control group that would get nothing. Sorry, Wyoming. Okay, that's not going to happen. But suppose we used part of the economic stimulus package to give states grants of, say, $500 per resident, with more for states with especially high unemployment. States could use the money to cut taxes, subsidize employment, build roads, drop money from helicopters. Some might even come up with good ideas not on the Obama WizKids list. The feds would collect data from states on how they spent the money and measure how households and firms responded. This treasure trove of data would fuel research on what works and what doesn't. This isn't a perfect experiment. States' choices won't be random, but there are statistical techniques to deal with that. And we'd end up with a lot more information to assess policy options, 50 data points instead of one from a uniform national policy. States are the laboratories of democracy. We can learn from them how to cure our next recession. With our democracy facing the greatest economic threat since the Great Depression, it's time to fire up the Bunsen burners.
Len Berman is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute and co-director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. We invite your ideas at marketplace.org. There's no doubting the astonishing significance of the change of power that's playing out in Washington this week. Bono was among an all-star cast performing yesterday on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial with President-elect Obama looking on. The singer recalled the dream that Martin Luther King had spoken of on that very site 46 years earlier, and Bono declared, "On Tuesday, that dream comes to pass." Well, maybe not entirely. Despite tremendous progress, the dream of diversity still has some distance to go, especially in the American workplace. We're joined now by Steve Robbins, a diversity consultant based in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Thanks for lending us your insights.
Thank you very much for having me.
It was, if I remember correctly, back in 2000 or so that there was a big diversity push at corporations, big and small, and people were creating positions like director of diversity just to make sure goals were reached. So how are we doing so far?
I think the results are mixed. Some organizations are doing very well. Some haven't gone very far at all, and some just kind of are still lingering in from decades ago. So I think those organizations who put in chief diversity officers or others like that, who then also made diversity and inclusion initiatives a main priority, have made some strides.
And what have we specifically accomplished in the workplace?
One of the things we've done is help to reframe the work of diversity, moving it from what I call a social justice framework to what I call a problem-solving framework, and helping people to recognize that diversity is not just race and gender. It's about bringing different types of perspectives together to make an organization stronger.
Does the workplace largely remain a white male domain, if you will?
We tend to find our diversity, if you're talking about racial and gender diversity, we tend to find that type of diversity in the lower ranks. So the white and male tends to be still the description of the power places in organizations.
So what's the answer toward continuing to change that?
I think it's white and male, meaning white males, I think, have to step out of their world and invite other people in on an intentional basis. I rarely find any white male leaders who intentionally want to keep people out. It's the unintentional things that we do, not inviting certain folks to play golf with us, or not inviting certain folks to go to lunch with us, or just hanging out with what I call our homies and not inviting other people in.
Do you think the fact that we are going to have an African-American president in the White House will help us reach our goals?
I think it has the great potential to. It also has the potential to lead some people to let their guard down, meaning some people might look at what's going to happen tomorrow as, well, see, it proves that our society in the United States is an open one where the playing field is level, when in fact having an African-American president does not necessarily prove that.
Well, coincidental to the African-American president, we're also facing some of the biggest economic challenges in our memories. How hard is it in a down economy to achieve these diversity goals in that climate?
It is very, very difficult. Organizations kind of work like human beings. When we're under stress in economic times, they try to find their comfort zones. And then they also then try to focus on what they've prioritized. Diversity and inclusion historically has been something that organizations do when everything's going well. Now more organizations are starting to understand that, yeah, even in downtimes, we need to find a way to engage all of our employees and also engage potential employees who are, when you look at the demographic mix, that the best and brightest of the 21st century world don't look like the best and brightest of the 20th century world.
Steve Robbins is a diversity consultant based in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Bob.
Coming up, matching expectations with reality.
As people would learn more about those people, it turns out you like the other person less. And there's no question that this is likely to happen with everybody, including with Obama.
But first, let's do the numbers. It might have been a good thing that Wall Street was closed for the holiday, given the downward momentum in Europe today. The British government's new plan to insure bank loans may have been aimed at easing stock market pressures, but it also announced it's boosting its stake in the Royal Bank of Scotland from 58% up to 70%. And that ended up sparking new worries it could be headed toward full nationalization of one or more banks. Britain's FTSE stumbled 0.9%. Likewise, the CAC 40 in Paris. Germany's DAX fared even worse, dropping 1.2%. Asian markets were still catching up to Friday's Wall Street rally. Tokyo's Nikkei edged up 0.3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 423 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce emissions. CSX, how tomorrow moves. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. France holds a summit for its car makers. The government is expected to announce several aid measures, including a jobs plan. Nominations for Britain's 2009 Pop Music Awards are announced in London. and soul superstar Aretha Franklin sings at Barack Obama's inauguration. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. As if we needed any more confirmation, tomorrow's inauguration will prove once and for all there is a new rock star of global politics. The new chief executive takes power amid an international outpouring of goodwill. Many countries are pinning their hopes for global economic recovery on Mr. Obama. But beneath the adulation, there is an undercurrent of anxiety. Our European correspondent Stephen Beard has been talking to some of the Obama doubters across the Atlantic.
The love affair started last summer. As a presidential candidate, Barack Obama addressed a huge crowd in Berlin. He pledged to finally heal the rift between the U.S. and Europe.
Partnership and cooperation among nations is not a choice. It is the only way to protect our common security and advance our common humanity.
Since the election, Europe has been awash in Obamamania. Politicians across the continent are falling over themselves to cozy up to the new leader. Even the Irish are claiming he's one of their own.
O'Leary, O'Reilly, O'Hare and O'Hara, there's no one as Irish as Barack Obama.
But not everyone has succumbed to Obama worship.
I'm not really quite sure why people are so excited about Obama, other than perhaps that he isn't Bush.
Philip Booth of the British free market think tank, the Institute of Economic Affairs.
I think probably why many European leaders are welcoming Obama's election is because, quite simply, they expect him to be something of a socialist in terms of economic policy.
Booth says that many European leaders see Obama as a kindred spirit, that under the cover of the economic crisis, the new president will try to bring European-style big government to the US.
For example, a huge fiscal expansion, increased government borrowing and increased government spending, intervention in industry.
But that doesn't mean Europe will benefit from its new economic soulmate. Analyst Andrew Hilton is another Obama skeptic. He says the incoming president is too close to the unions, more concerned about protecting American jobs than promoting free trade.
The AF of LCIO backs him and backs him very hard, and some of his cabinet picks are a worry in terms of his commitment to a global economy, to free trade.
During the campaign, candidate Obama flirted with the idea of tariffs to protect certain American industries from foreign competition. That would be a disaster, says Professor Jeffrey Wood of the Cass Business School.
Tariff protection, after all, in the Great Depression, made the situation very much worse, not just for the US, but for the rest of the world.
On the eve of an historic inauguration, expressing doubts about Obama may seem peevish and unwarranted. Europe's love affair continues. But, say the doubters, it may not last for long. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
It's certainly not just the Europeans who have lofty hopes for the president-elect. A CBS News New York Times poll found a combined 68% of Americans expect Mr. Obama will be a good or very good president. He seems to have noticed. Lately, he's been trying to play down those soaring expectations. Witness his remarks at the kickoff to his inaugural festivities on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial yesterday.
I won't pretend that meeting any one of these challenges will be easy. It will take more than a month or a year. It will likely take many.
He can try to ratchet down the perceptions, but Obama still faces some tough questions. What is he going to do to jumpstart the economy? Can he put forward a new bailout plan in record time? And with all these expectations, are we setting him up to fail? Our behavioral economist Dan Ariely has some thoughts on that. Dan, welcome to the program.
Very nice to be here.
So sure, you've got the pragmatists and just plain cynics out there who've questioned this man's qualifications through the campaign, really. But I wonder about the flip side. Does he need to worry more about this almost savior-like mantle that he's been given?
Yes. So it turns out that high hopes have both an upside and a downside. So let me tell you first about the upside. We did some experiments on something very simple, which is beer and vinegar. We gave people two glasses of beer, one had vinegar, one did not. And we said, try these two cups and tell us which one you want a big jug of.
Yum.
Well, here's what happened. When we did not tell the people about the vinegar, the beer with the vinegar was more popular. It actually tasted better. People liked it more. But when we told people about the vinegar, they hated it. Now, what's interesting here is that the moment they thought that vinegar would be terrible in beer, that self-fulfilling prophecy actually made the beer less palatable. So when you expect something to be bad, it actually will be bad. And no matter how much beer they tasted, it just didn't correct their impressions. And I think the same thing would happen for Obama. The people who have high positive expectations from him will see his actions in a much more popular and positive way, and therefore will get a more positive impression about him.
But as we learn more, how are those expectations of Mr. Obama likely to change?
Yeah, so that's the downside, of course. And here I'll tell you a little bit about something we found from online dating. We found that when people describe themselves in very vague terms, a lot of people like them. So if I say I like music, everybody thinks initially that I like the kind of music they like, and there's a good chance they'll like me too. But as people would learn more about those people, it turns out you like the other person less. And there's no question that this is likely to happen with everybody, including with Obama.
So are you saying lay low here? Mr. Obama needs to stay out of the spotlight?
So I think so. I think the more ambiguous he will be in terms of what we know about him, the more chances we will have to maintain his positive image. And he has to do something else, which is he has to manage these expectations. One of the things that can happen is that when these expectations will start crashing down, people would become disenchanted. And I think it will be very important for him in his inaugural address and in general in his initial days in office is to basically lower the expectations so we don't have this burn and crash reaction.
Well, I have to tell you, the more I hear about this, I don't know how I'm supposed to feel.
Well, I think we're all supposed to feel hopeful. I mean, that's what would keep us alive for now. Things are very depressing around us, and we need hope. And we're clinging to hope in the Obama case. We're clinging to the hope that he will deliver us. I mean, some of the way you see people and hear people react to this, it's as if he's a messiah. And we need to cling to some of it, but not to too much of it, I think.
Dan Ariely is a professor at Duke University and the author of Predictably Irrational. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure, as always.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, a nationwide recall of peanut butter products expanded today. The latest recall involves peanut butter crackers made by Kellogg's under the Austin Quality Foods label. Federal officials have warned consumers to avoid products that contain peanut butter until they determine the full scope of the outbreak. It's already sickened close to 500 people in 43 states. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. The domestic markets were closed for the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, the fantasy and lore of inauguration parties.
When you watch balls and events on television, you always have this grandiose idea of, I'll feel like Cinderella when I'm there, and there will be, you know, tablecloths and all these things.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.